Hey up, it's the No Nay Never podcast with your host, Jamie Smith.
Hello and welcome to this week's No Nay Never podcast. It probably will be a slightly shorter podcast than normal because we only have a couple of guests. James and Adam are joining me for this evening and we'll be talking about Spurs, Danny Ings' future and also the return to fitness of Sam Vokes, among other things, I'm sure. James, we'll start with you then, as your one of the only guests on the show. There's no point in trying to rotate the strike as normal. What did you make of Burnley's performance on Saturday?
I thought it was very positive, actually. You know, feel maybe a little disappointed that we didn't manage to get a point out of it. I thought there was periods of the game where we were causing Spurs some real problems. But I think, again, it was sort of typical, maybe the last ball and the finishing that sort of let us down. And when you're in our position, I think you've got to take every chance you get rather than, you know, only converting one every few.
It's a strange game, really, because in some ways I think Spurs were much better than us, but you'd expect them to be because they're a top six team. But in other ways, yeah, I think we matched them. I don't think it would have been really unfair if we'd have got a point from it, even though they probably had more chances overall. I think we probably did do enough to get a draw. At the start of the second half in particular, we were causing real problems. I think Lloris has made three saves in quite short succession from Danny Ings, and those are probably the sort of chances where you think we've got to make sure we put one of those away.
Yeah, I thought Lloris actually had a really, really good game. You know, particularly when you look back at how he started his time at Spurs, where I think he was seen as a bit calamitous. He definitely did a good job of keeping us at bay. But I think what really disappointed me about Spurs was the way they sort of played counter-attacking football. I mean, a side that's assembled as, you know, with the kind of money they've spent playing against, you know, the lowest budget team the Premier League has probably ever seen, comparatively. It's a bit disappointing to see them go with counter-attacking football. And in particular, I thought Eric Lamella scored an absolutely fantastic goal. But other than that, there is no way he's worth £30 million. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
It's really funny one, Lamella, because obviously he started quite poorly, but seems to be a consensus that he's coming into a bit of form. And it's amazing that was his first goal in the Premier League after, what, nearly 18 months. I mean, it's a great goal. But yeah, even considering that was probably one of his better games for Spurs, he wasn't really that good, although there were a couple of moments where Ben Mee struggled to cope with him. But then, like you say, it's a £30 million player and he probably should be causing problems for our defence.
No, definitely. I mean, Ben Mee costs, what, I think £600,000. So there's a little bit of difference between, you know, costs of those two. And particularly, I'd say, you know, Ben Mee's maybe not the strongest left-back defensively going when someone runs at him. So you would expect a player like Lamella to have the beating of him.
I suppose we should talk about all three goals. We wouldn't normally just go through the goals, but I think that all something worth picking out from. The first Spurs goal in particular, I'm not sure what sort of view you had of it at White Hart Lane, but there's been plenty of debate since, particularly regarding the offside part of it. First of all, do you think it was a fair free kick for the handball on Michael Keane?
Couldn't really say. We were sort of down in the opposite end in the corner that the incident happened on. I mean, it did look a bit soft. It was one of those ones where I don't think Keane could really do a lot about it hitting him. So it technically is handball, but at the same time, it's like, has he really gained an advantage from it? Whereas I think there was an incident not long after where Spurs clearly did gain an advantage from a handball that was sort of similar, where he couldn't get out of the way of it, but it's actually put it under control and into his path. So you'd think that should be a free kick if he's, you know, gained some sort of advantage from his arm being involved. But I think for me, the free kick was just taken far too quickly. I'm not sure often you'd see a referee not bring that one back, because they take it quickly. Everyone still kind of stood around, including a lot of Spurs players, which is, I think, how you know, you find a player in an offside position. But then not only that, I'm pretty sure Eriksen interferes with play, because just the fact he's there and everyone stops because he's there. And, you know, as a result, there's no one there to even challenge for the next ball. So I'd see that as him interfering with play, to be honest.
I agree with you. We had quite a lot of debate on Twitter on Saturday night about this. It was the laws of the game were being quoted at me, which is a sign of where it sort of got to. But yeah, I think it does come down to interpretation in the end. And surely the fact Eriksen is so far offside and the ball goes so close to him and all our defenders stop because they assume he's going to be offside, surely that has caused the distraction that means it should be offside. Should mention as well that talking about how quickly the free kick was taken, the ball was moving when Kane took the free kick, so that's another reason why it shouldn't have stood, but should credit Spurs as well, I suppose. Kane, that's the sort of speed of thought that you want from a top-level player, isn't it? And he was there to get on the end of it as well. But from Burnley's point of view, two or three reasons certainly why it could have been disallowed, but we did switch off a little bit.
I haven't seen it again, and from where I was sat, it'd be a bit brave to say, but if it was, yeah, it did look from our angle like it wasn't a dead ball.
Yeah, it was only clear from, I think it was about the fifth replay of it on Match of the Day, and it was their analysts who actually picked up on it, but yeah, it was rolling, and like I say, it was taken very quickly. But I also think maybe a tiny bit of naivety from our defenders allowing that free kick to be taken so quickly. You'd normally think, just get in the way, don't let them do it.
You know, I think everyone's seen it sort of at Sunday League and, you know, junior football, stand on it, as they say, and get one guy just stood directly in front of it until at least, you know, a couple of you got into position.
The positive, though, was that we reacted really well to going behind, which we've done quite a few times this season, and the goal from Ashley Barnes, so I don't know about you, but I didn't know he was capable of doing that.
That was an absolute peach. in terms of players you don't expect to score that, I think that's up there with Stephen Thompson's goal at Reading.
Oh yeah, that was a cracker.
You know, where you don't expect that player to have that strike, and I haven't seen any of the goals again, but it looked to move a lot. It was hard to tell because it was sort of in our corner, but at one point I thought it was going high and wide, and you're like, oh nice, it's dropping in, and it just, you know, the keeper was getting nowhere near it. It was an absolute peach of a finish.
Yeah, it certainly swerved away from Lloris, and I think it dipped as well, and it certainly seemed to wrong fussing. I think it was partly just that he wasn't expecting him to shoot from there. When Boyd plays him in, he sort of takes a step away from goal when he brings it under control, but then hits it.
And he's kind of got a defender right in front of him as well, and normally you'd think he's going to instead just try and find someone to lay it off for, but can't really complain when he hits one like that.
Just going to say, Lloris is one of those goalkeepers that you actually expect to save things like that. So it's kind of testament to Ashley Barnes that a goalkeeper of Lloris's standard was beaten by that goal. I've seen that a couple of times now, and it was just so shocking. I was just like, "Is that Ashley Barnes? Is that Ashley Barnes?" And he still didn't smile afterwards. So he's still kept the bad boy kind of.
He's very
I'm never
cool
happy.
Dude. I suppose it's just a sign of how confident he must be. He's obviously scored a couple of winning goals since coming into the side, and that's just a real indication of how he must be feeling. And we'll talk about Sam Vokes and whether he's going to come back into the side later, but Barnes has certainly made his case in the last few weeks, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, regardless of, you know, what else he's contributed, he's scored goals, and when you look at strikers, ultimately you judge them on whether they score or not, not whether they, you know, ran around enough for your liking.
I still see, like, people on Twitter criticising Ashley Barnes, and it's like, well, he's actually scoring, so why do you still, like, some people hate him, like, it's like,
it is very odd.
It's because, like, it's because I think he doesn't, some players give the impression of doing a lot, and Ashley Barnes is not one of those players. Like, he does not look like he's working hard, and he does not look like he's doing stuff that is actually productive to the team, so maybe that's why.
I think there are things about him that rub people up a little bit the wrong way. I mean, he's certainly quite rough as a player. I think that's a fair way to describe it. He does hit the deck quite easily at times, and I know a lot of people don't really like that. I don't really like that, so there is that. But also, I think Burnley fans have this thing of they make their minds up about a player early, and no matter what the evidence is after that, they just don't change their minds. So we've got people on No Name Ever saying that Barnes isn't even a Championship player, even when he's scoring winning goals in the Premier League. It's like, well, at some point you've got to accept that he's performing well at this level.
It's not that he dives, it's that he dives so badly. Like, I wouldn't mind as much if it didn't look like he was diving, but he's the most, like, flamboyant diver for the least flamboyant player ever.
He's not very good at it, is he?
I think he could actually join sort of Lee Grant levels of complete blindness of refusing to change opinion, because that was another one obviously where everyone hated him. And even though he had an absolutely amazing season in his last year for us, whenever you see people comment about Derby scores, you always see a Burnley player go, "Well, it's because they got that Lee Grant in net." Always said he was rubbish.
It's like any excuse to justify the opinion that they already hold is brilliant, and ignore anything else that they've done well. But I think
it's quite common on the internet for people just to resort to point scoring. Like it's just I said that really early, so therefore I'm right. Therefore I get more points than you in the game that is the internet.
There was one. We'll come to the Spurs winner next, but we're talking about whether Burnley should have done better with it, and someone resorted to saying, "I just don't think you get defending." I was like, "Well, if you're going to bring the debate down to that level, there's no point in really having it, is it? It's like you don't understand football." It's like, "Well, what's the point talking about it?" Spurs winning goal, then, James. Again, not sure what sort of view you had of it from White Hart Lane, but it's an excellent goal from Lamela's, firstly. But does Ben Mee give him a little bit of too much space, and does George Boyd do enough to get back as well?
I think maybe the George Boyd point might be valid. But then, you know, he is a guy who does a lot of running, so you almost want to give him the benefit of the doubt that if he didn't get back, it wasn't because he wasn't, you know, he was capable of it and just couldn't be bothered. But as far as Ben Mee gives him space, I think you can look at it, you know, two ways, that if he'd closed him down and then he gets absolutely done by him and, he's played himself out of the game, people are probably criticising him for, you know, getting too close to his man and getting beaten easily and then giving someone a free cross. And on the other hand, you stand off him and he hits a shot like that, you don't expect someone to hit a strike like that. And, you know, it's an absolutely top draw finish at the end of the day. You know, there's nothing Tom Heaton can do about it. And I'm not sure that, you know, if you're closing down a lot more than being practically stood on him, you stop him really managing to get that away.
I think you're right, and I think Lamela had gone on the outside just before his goal and Mee had struggled to cope with it, so he probably was wary of that happening again. Boyd's getting back was fine, it's just that once Lamela came inside, he didn't seem to close him down. He just sort of stood off and allowed him to get the shot away. Mee sort of showed him inside, and then Boyd didn't do his bit next.
Maybe that's something that Mee was just trying to do to cover his own back. I don't know, really.
Yeah, I don't know whether maybe George Boyd had the penalty incident sort of fresh in his mind.
That's true as well.
A little, because I know that there was at least a couple of Burnley fans who, every time he got even near the ball, seemed to shout about him only tackling in his own area.
Brilliant. never underestimate Burnley fans. Excellent. Overall, though, I think it's really encouraging of how far we've come this season, that we drew 2-1 at Spurs, who I think are probably going to be a top six team at least, and we're probably a little bit disappointed that we didn't get anything from the game. That shows what a good run we're on at the moment.
Yeah, I spoke to quite a few Spurs fans on the way, on the tube and on the walk to the tube, and they seemed pretty impressive. They thought that, you know, maybe we could have got something out of the game. Obviously, they were happy that they got the 3 points, but I don't think they thought it'd be too unfair if we had got something from them. And I think as well, a lot were really impressed with Danny Ings, who I thought did actually have a really good game. And it's just a shame that I think every chance he got was sort of moving away from the net, where, you know, maybe if he'd got one where he could properly get on one-on-one with the keeper, he might have had a chance to score.
Yeah, I think all the Ings opportunities are what I'd call sort of half chances. I think you're right. He was going away from goal and he seemed to be trying to beat Lloris at the near post, which I'm not sure was the greatest plan, but when you're going away from goal, it is difficult, isn't it? And he was forcing saves, so you can't be too critical.
Yeah, you're running out of net at that point, so I guess all you can really hope for is, you know, get it on target, and if it gets through, it gets through, and if it doesn't, then, you know, you probably won a corner from that kind of angle.
One little question mark, and it does feel like we talk about this all the time, so I don't want to go into too much detail on it, but we did wait a long time again to make substitutions, and there was a period of the game sort of just after the hour mark when it felt like it was drifting a little bit. Spurs had got on top, and I just didn't understand why we waited until the last 12 minutes again to make a change. Dash must have his reasons. I just can't work out what they are.
I guess it comes down to, like, his kind of undying faith in his players. Like, yeah, I don't know if he's if it's foolish to be so like stubborn. But I don't even know if it's stubbornness anyway. He might just want to wait until the last minute anyway, just to see if anything comes of it. Because I have to say, we have been in the position as fans where we feel, oh, well, this substitution won't work. Well, this substitution is too late. And it's gone ahead and it's actually produced results.
Yeah, a very good example of that actually is the Blackburn game at home.
The Sam Vokes.
Where Sam Vokes got the equaliser and someone shouted behind Dash, what good's putting him on now going to do? There's 2 minutes left. And then he scores. So...
Counter arguments that though. The guy in the stand might say, if you put him on 5 minutes earlier, he might score twice.
Michael Cartley was definitely getting ready at about 65, 70 minutes. You could see him on the bench doing his tape on his wrists, and then he seemed to go quiet again. And he ran up and down the touchline a bit longer, and you were thinking any minute now he's getting called over, and that's it. He's getting on, but it did take a long time. And it is disappointing because obviously when the two came on, I don't think they really had much opportunity to do anything. And it was a period where we seemed to get back on the front foot and put Spurs under quite a lot of late pressure. And obviously Ross Wallace nearly managed to repeat his heroics at Leicester with a late free kick as well.
That's the issue for me. I think if you're waiting that late, it's probably going to take them 5 minutes maybe to get into the game, and then you're looking at they've got 5 to 10 minutes left, and you're asking an awful lot for someone to make an impact. But I think Adam is right. I think it's the trust and the faith that he has in his players that he's put out there, and he obviously feels like they can get the job done. But I think it's
there were a lot of complaints about Scott Arfield actually coming from Burnley fans on Saturday. And I think a lot of people were sort of hoping he'd get taken off sort of the 50-55 minute mark. I don't think he had that bad a game, but a lot of people didn't seem impressed with him. And I think when you saw Cartley was getting ready at that stage, it almost looked like maybe Dash was thinking the same thing, but then obviously he doesn't make the change as soon as he looks like he's got it lined up.
It's a funny one, Arfield, isn't it? Because he's certainly having a bit of a dodgy patch, but I'm starting to wonder now if when he started the season playing really well, if that was more the outlier and this is more just what Arfield's level now. I mean, he was so good in the opening week, so we're just expecting too much for him to be doing that all the time.
He started so well that now whenever he's not that good, everyone seems like an outlier, when it's probably more common that he isn't that good, especially at this stage in the season. We've had enough games now.
I think ultimately people maybe forget sort of the situation Arfield came from, where he wasn't necessarily a first team regular at Huddersfield. He came to us. He's played out of position with us the whole time. I know you don't agree with that, Jamie, but he plays out of position. And ultimately, he's probably outperformed what anyone at his previous club thought he was capable of. Stepping up to the Premier League, he's certainly outperformed what a lot of people think he's capable of. And I think ultimately the issue comes down to that maybe he was a standout player at the beginning of the season, but I think maybe as much as maybe his game dropping slightly, I think the rest of our team have raised their game, and maybe they're playing with the same sort of belief that he was playing with at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
And as a result, he's sort of, his performance now has averaged out to the rest of the teams.
Also at the, like in the close season, during Dash's, transfer activity, Scott Arfield was built up to be this amazing messiah who came from nothing and like it was amazing, and that was the kind of player that everyone who had faith in Dyche's transfer kind of dealings, that was the thing that was used all the time. So maybe that has also added to the kind of expectation that lies on him, and then once he starts well, that just kind of corroborates any feeling.
No, it's true. I mean, he did sort of get put on a pedestal, wasn't he? I mean, any player that people didn't rate that we went after, it was always, yeah, but Scott Arfield. And I used to just go, yeah, but Ryan Noble. Like, you can't just say Scott Arfield and that'd be the end of the argument. It doesn't work. But, yeah, I just think in recent weeks he's not had the verve that I really associate with Arfield. He's not looked like he's been taking people on like he was in the first few weeks. And I don't know if he's fully fit, but just seems like his confidence is a bit low at the minute. I'd be thinking about resting him in inverted quote marks. I think it's time for him to have a couple of games on the sidelines and see if somebody else can do a bit better.
And on that, I think actually, I thought Carty was a little hard done by, dropping out the side after the Stoke game. Because I watched the Stoke game, obviously, when I was away in America, and I thought, you know, Carty, you know, did a good job. Obviously, he set up Ings's goal. And I think, you know, after he didn't start in the team at the beginning of the season, I think he, you know, he did a good job once he was in the side. And obviously, I do like having two properly recognised wingers. Because I think if you we're going to play, you know, in the Premier League against higher levels, you know, better opponents, I think having two wingers helps us on the break with the chance of stealing a goal on the counter attack like we did at Stoke.
Yeah, I think Kyle is a difficult one because he was excellent in the game at Stoke, but he played against Villa in the next game, and I thought he was really poor that game. So I think that's what you get with Kyle. Sometimes he can be really hit and miss. I think that's why Dash prefers Arfield, because he's much more a solid player. You know you're going to get a 6, 7 out of 10 out of Arfield, I think. But yeah, I think it's time to give Kiley a go, certainly for one of the games over Christmas. Obviously, the games come thick and fast this time of year. You can't be expecting anyone to start all four of the next four. You've got four games in, what is it, about 10 days or something. There's going to have to be some level of rotation. Yeah, that's true. I mean, Liverpool, you would expect they'll, we'll preview the two Christmas games a bit later, but Liverpool, you'll expect they'll dominate the ball. City will be the same. We're going to have to do an awful lot of running in those two games in 3 days, and I just don't think you can expect the same group of players to do it. Someone who I am sure is going to play 90 minutes in both games, though, is Jason Shackle, who, there's an incredible stat that the last 100 league games, he's played every single minute. He's not been substituted. He hasn't missed a game through injury. Hasn't been suspended. Since Dash came in as manager, he's played every single minute in the league. And I think it's about time that we started recognising just what an incredible presence Jason Shackle's been for our football club.
I think you know, Shaq's been amazing. Particularly after, I'd say, the Chelsea game this year, when everyone came into expecting Duff to be the weak link. And actually, like, it was Shackle. He was a little bit nervous, you know, with the level he was playing at. But I don't think you can argue with the way he's played since. So clearly that was just, you know, maybe first game nerves. But I think he's, you know, he's been sensational. It's been the case the whole way through Dash's time at the club. I think obviously when he first came under Eddie Howe, he had a bit of an injury problem, which I think meant he wasn't fully fit. And you were sort of left wondering if we got the player we thought we were getting. But I think, you know, since then you can't really argue with what he's done. And I think he was lucky not to get a goal as well on Saturday when he had a header at the back post that, you know, maybe you could say he might have done better with on another day.
I just look back and wonder how different things might have been if we'd been able to get Shackle a year earlier when Howe tried to get him. I mean, it's been so important for the club. It could have all worked out different, and we might have ended up keeping Howe because the defence was so poor. That's one of the reasons he left, I think, and we've been generally solid.
Because I think, you know, even when he did come in, the defence didn't really look to improve. And I think that's probably what you sacrifice with Eddie Howe's football, you know, in the same way that we did with Owen Coyle. You never expected us to keep clean sheets. But, you know, I think ultimately Eddie Howe moving on, clearly he's been the best for pretty much everyone involved. Obviously, he's doing really well now at Bournemouth. We've got promoted to the Premier League, and Jason Shackle, obviously, is probably playing the best football of his career.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's an interesting alternative reality, maybe, where Shackle did come to Burnley a year earlier. I just wonder how it would have worked out. Just staying on Shackle, I think the last few weeks as well have really shown his qualities, because he's used to playing with Michael Duff, who looks after himself. He knows the game inside out. But now he's having to sort of guide Michael Keane a little bit, because he is quite raw, although I've been impressed with him so far. And it's different when you've got somebody else to worry about alongside you. And I think we've seen in the last few weeks that Shackle's leadership qualities are completely outstanding. And I think you're right, the fact that he didn't start the season well, but the last few weeks he's been brilliant, it really shows his quality for me. And I think Robbie wrote a piece on the site about his contracts. He's got 18 months left on his contracts, and maybe we should be thinking about extending that, even though he's 31. I think if Shackle was still here at the end of his career, I'd be absolutely delighted.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think centre-backs as well do tend to play on, you know, to an older age than you'd expect to play in other positions. I mean, obviously, look at Michael Duff, he's still going. And I'd say even at his peak, he wasn't close to the you know, the quality of player that Jason Shackle is. But it's an interesting point you make about, you know, Duff being out at the moment and how you've had you know, an experienced head next year. He doesn't really need telling him what to do. Obviously, you still need to lead because you're the, you know, the captain, as well as the guy who's expected to lead the defence. But Michael Duff knows what he's doing. He wouldn't still be a pro if he didn't. But on Michael Keane, I've actually been really impressed with Michael Keane. He's a similar type of player, I think, to Jason Shackle. He does like to sort of get the ball at his feet every now and then. And it is, I think it's been good for the side that his distribution is, I'd say, considerably better than Michael Duff's, who quite often goes with the sort of long and hope approach. But, you know, I think it's been good. Bringing Michael Keane, I think it's important because when you bring in these players on loan, you sort of need to show that you're willing to give them a chance and get them game time, otherwise other clubs aren't going to want to loan out their young players to you, because ultimately them sitting on the bench for you is no different to them sitting on the bench for them. So it's been good to see, obviously, Shaq and Keane together recently.
Well, there's that, and obviously Keane and Shalabar, their loans both run out in January. I think Shalabar's probably a foregone conclusion. I'll be amazed if we keep him, but Keane's probably a bit more up in the air. Obviously, he's played the last few games for us, but it's not clear whether he'll keep his place when Duff gets fit. And Man United still having quite a lot of problems at the back. Where do you see that situation going? Obviously, it's very difficult to tell, but United have been playing Michael Carrick at the back recently, so there is still a bit of a shortage there, but they could go out and buy someone. Do you think we've got a good chance of keeping him for the rest of the season?
I'd say we probably have a chance of keeping him. I think United are playing a really strange sort of defensive line recently. I've seen that they've been using obviously Young and Valencia a lot as sort of wing backs, and since I don't think either of those have an ounce of defensive ability in them, it just looks really bizarre. But you know, I'm just not sure how they'd you know, whether they'd see Michael Keane as someone they're going to play for the rest of the season. You know, particularly when obviously they do have the option in January to go out and spend if they want to. So I'd probably suspect that they're more likely to spend something and bring in someone who's, you know, ready-made rather than turn to youth right now.
I think the issue with Keane at United as well is, obviously, if he hadn't come to Burnley, he probably would have had a chance and maybe would have been ahead of Tyler Blackett and Paddy McNair. But because he left and they got a goal, he's probably below them now just because Van Gaal's seen what they're about and he knows what to expect from them. So, yeah, there's a chance they can go out and buy. I think they've got to get players fit at some point. So you'd think maybe Jones and Rojo are going to be the two main centre-backs when they've got players fit. So Keane could go back there and find himself third choice even among the young standings. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that we can certainly extend that loan until the end of the season and then assess it and maybe get a permanent deal done, because like you, I'm very impressed and I totally agree on distribution. I think he's got a big plus over Duff in that area. And I think it's important in the Premier League to have centre-backs who are comfortable on the ball, because it allows you to bring the ball out from the back and not have to hit it from hit it down the field so much, and it just ends up coming back. So yeah, really hopeful that we can keep Keane.
And on the distribution, I think you see quite a lot with us the way our two centre midfielders play, particularly you know, David Jones. Quite often he gets the ball under pressure, and if he gets under pressure, quite often the only outlet is a centre-back. And then obviously someone closes down the centre-back who gets it, and you need to pass it to the other one. And I think having two centre-backs who can both play the ball means that no matter which centre-back he knocks it back to, as soon as they knock it onto the other one as they're getting closed down, you've got someone who's you know, capable of making the next pass and finding another claret shirt.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with the two-man midfield, isn't it? Jones is quite often under pressure, and he's taken a bit of stick recently from supporters, but I think it's not really any fault of his own. It's that he's playing in a two against a three most weeks, and he's just under pressure and he doesn't have the pace to go past players. But there was a stat, he made 7 interceptions on Saturday, which was more than anyone, and he won the ball back to start the move that settled the Barnes goal. So I think it does need to be said when he does things right, because he is getting some pelters, and I think that's been a bit unfair. I think overall Jones has probably been one of our better players this season.
Yeah, I mean, you know, ultimately you're playing against teams that, I know they always say you get more space in the Premier League, but I think that's I don't know whether it's a visual effect or something, because you definitely don't, at least not in the middle. You know, he's getting a touch and turning, and in the Championship he was still stood with the ball and no one was near him. in the Premier League, he's getting a touch and turn and there's someone on him. And, you know, I think he holds the ball well, even under pressure. But quite often, obviously, the only option is to go back because that's the only place you've got a guaranteed pass. And I think someone actually behind me at the game on Saturday said at one point where he passed forward and he got picked off. They said, oh, that's why he passes back all the time. It's like, well, what do you expect? You're playing a two-man midfield. Quite often, our wingers push up straight away as well. So you're asking him to make a pass through, you know, three opposition midfielders. You know, if you do that 10 times, you're going to get, you know, three or four that get picked off.
Yeah, I just think Burnley fans seem to always have to have someone to have a bit of a go at. And now Barnes has started doing quite well. It needs to be somebody else's turn. And maybe it just seems to be David Jones who's in the firing line at the moment.
You've also got to remember in the Premier League, teams will also target players and have specific tactics that are tailored to teams much more than in the Championship. So in the midfield, they're going to see David Jones, know his lack of pace and target him and try and stop the ball going through that area much more in the Championship. So that maybe there is more space in the Premier League, but just not for the people who can be dangerous with it, like David Jones.
I think you do see that kind of thing. Well, obviously, teams are going to watch tape before the game. And I think we even saw it in the Championship when Brian Stock played. As a guy who was obviously quite established in the Championship, a lot of teams would have played against him before. And they would have known that he liked time on the ball. And you'd see people try and hassle him as well. And I think it's just it's the same thing, obviously, at a different level, which means, obviously, that the hassling's even more effective because players are just quicker and bigger and stronger.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I think you're right about the space issue, but the fact that players are faster means that space gets eaten up a lot quicker. It might look like Jones has got time and space, but by the time he's turned, it's not there anymore. And also, I think because he is so left-footed, I think it's unfair for people to have a go at him over this. He's 30 years old or something. He's always been very left-footed, so he's not going to change now. But again, that's something teams will know about him. They know that if you try and get him on his right foot, he's going to want to go on his left foot and you can cause problems for him. So I think it's a learning curve for all the players. And I think Jones is just, he needs to adapt a bit better to it. But I've got every faith in him. I think he's one of our better players and I think he's going to be fine. What I want to talk about next is Danny Ings. And James thought he played really well on Saturday. I thought he wasn't that good compared to some of his recent games, but his future is always going to be up for debate, I suppose, with his contract situation, which we have done to death. Sean Dyche has said today that we've got no intention of selling him, which is good news. He's pointed out that the chairman have said that Ings isn't going anywhere, and Dyche said, I'm happy with that as a manager. I suppose the risk is that someone comes in with a very big offer and means that there is a decision to make, but from a football perspective, it makes no sense to sell him, and even from a business one, it would take a massive bid to be anything like what we could earn from staying up, and our best chance of staying up is if we keep Danny Ings, surely.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at it from a very simple view, is that if you think about how much we signed Danny for, however many years ago it was now, plus wages, plus whatever it cost to have his treatment when he had the serious knee injury, it's impossible to see a situation where that hasn't already been paid back by what he achieved for us last season. So from my point of view, as a business decision, he's now effectively almost a zero cost. You'd think if from the money we earned from last season, you'd probably say you've broken even on Danny Ings already. So if he has a really good season this year, we stay up. That's just pure profit off the back of him. So if you lose him and go to a tribunal, and I think there is evidence there that tribunals recently have given for some players, decent fees, you're not going to get what maybe you could have got if he had 2 years on his contract, but that's never been a situation that's possible. And you get people who say, you should sign a contract just so we can get more money for him, but that's not in his, in his interest. And I don't know why in football it's seen as a different scenario to any other walk of life where, would you expect someone to sign a new contract just out of courtesy for having been with you for a while, even when they know you're accepting you're going to leave? It's just hard to see how that can be expected in football. But I think when you look at, what you'd still get from a tribunal, I think you'd get at least 5 million. Regardless of what happens this season. I think there's really absolutely no risk to keeping him now and waiting for the end of the season. You know, because if we do get relegated and he hasn't had a particularly good season, maybe this is a good spell now and he drops back off again, the chances are we're front runner to sign him. And then, you know, you've got a chance to get back up with him.
I think you're right. And 5 million's maybe a little ambitious. I think 3-4 would probably be bare minimum. I think Junior Hoylett was a good example that we can be hopeful for. I think he went for about 7 when he had a similar tribunal situation. So we could be looking at that much.
That's kind of what I'm basing it on, because they are supposed to take into account what impact they have on your side. And I think it's, no one can argue that Danny Ings, when you look at our team sheet, he's our big name, he's our player who's the biggest influence. I mean, you take him out of the side, that's clearly a big loss for us. And as a result, I'd say the tribunal would probably go more towards, like the way that Hoylett one did. Maybe with 2 years on his contract, you get 10 million for Danny Ings. But that's just not a situation that's ever been there to play out. So people who harp on about that, you're just living in a dreamland, because that's never been a scenario that's even been close to reality.
We've got the same problem as well as we had in the summer, in that we've got to try and replace him somehow. And Troy Deeney seems to be the main target in the summer, and Watford were quoting 10 million. So we've got to think, if we were to sell Ings in January, we have to go out and get someone who can score goals in the Premier League as a replacement. And they're going to cost 10 million quid, probably, and it's a hell of a lot of money, but that's what these sorts of players cost.
They're probably going to cost more in January because...
Exactly.
Well, we had inflated prices in the summer, but in January it's just ridiculous. So to sell Danny Ings in January just wouldn't make any sense. And I think we're all going to get tired of it being played out in the press, because he is now getting attention. He's I was watching Goals on Sunday, Sam Allardyce was the guest, and he pointed out Ings as a star player and said he's adapting to the Premier League and that he'd be a great player. So it just shows that if Sam Allardyce is saying that on TV, and I saw a tweet from BBC Sport the other day that said, which would you rather start for England, Danny Ings, Charlie Austin, and I think Andy Carroll or someone like that. So if he's been compared to people like that on the biggest in the biggest news outlets out there, then it's just going to happen now. But I don't think it actually makes any sense for us to sell him. And probably Sean Dyche will get tired of saying the same thing over and over again as well.
I think it's one of those things that it's inevitable that people are going to talk about it, because he is our star player, his contract's running out. For me, it's been pretty obvious from the summer that he's going to go at the end of his contract, and I've got no problem with that, but it is something that people are going to talk about. And we saw earlier in the season, when he wasn't scoring, that a lot of people were using the contracts as a reason to hit him with a stick, just because they say, oh, he likes commitment and so on. But I think the last few weeks have proven that that's rubbish, really, and he's shown on the pitch that he's as committed to the club as he needs to be. Dash has said that we still have open dialogue with Ings and his agent, whatever that means. And he also said, quite interestingly, the club have made it quite clear how much they value the players we've got at, and we're in a good position cash-wise because we haven't spent a lot of money. Now, that's probably about as bullish as we've ever been on finances. We're in a good position cash-wise. We're officially not skin, and that's fantastic. I want to stay on strikers for the minute, actually. Adam just touched on players who are being touted for England. I want to talk a little bit about Charlie Austin, who scored a hat-trick for QPR against West Brom on Saturday. Really pulled his team out of trouble again. They went 2-0 down before Austin's goals secured a 3-2 win that got them out of the drop zone, dropping us back in there. Harry Redknapp's been in the press saying that they've got no intention of selling Austin, but is it not inevitable that if a player's got 11 goals for such a poor side by Christmas, that teams are going to want to buy him? And I think Austin's only got 18 months left on his contract, and we've seen in the past how quickly Austin likes to move on, and I don't think it's any disrespect to him to suggest he's going to want to go to a bigger club.
Yeah, maybe, but I think Charlie Austin's actually a really strange one, because he's a dying breed of striker. A few Spurs fans mentioned him on Saturday, actually, and they just basically said that, old school striker, he's the old way of he scores goals and he doesn't really do a lot else. But I think QPR's reliance on him was, evident last season. I haven't done, the actual numbers, but I can only imagine they'd be mid-table if you took his goals out from last season. I mean, I know at one stage when we played them, obviously he was out again with his shoulder, they hadn't won a game where Charlie Austin hadn't been involved. So they were pretty reliant on him last season. And I think it's clear now that they're really reliant on his goals again this season.
2-0 yeah. down at the weekend, weren't they, before Charlie Austin scored his hat-trick and they won 3-2. So if anything is a mark of QPR's reliance on Charlie Austin, it's the fact that he needs to score three goals after they're 2-0 down at home, I think. I'm not sure if it was at home.
It was at QPR.
That's as good a marker as any to say how...
Well, he scored 11 goals already this season, and a good comparison is Burnley, who scored 12. So that just shows to me how far ahead of the teams at the bottom Austin is. I think he's just far too good for QPR. And might be wishful thinking, but I think it's inevitable he's going to go in January. There's too many teams that are going to want to buy a striker who scores that many goals. Now, I see what you mean about him being a dying breed, but I also think these things are a bit circular sometimes. And Diego Costa's not that dissimilar to Austin. Obviously, much better. But he's, again, sort of a penalty box poacher, and maybe they're just going to come back into fashion again. Who knows?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely sides you can look at and say, well, you probably really don't care how they get scored. You just want someone to score them. And I suggest maybe Arsenal are one of them, where, you know, they can play all the pretty football in the world, but just don't seem to necessarily score enough when they need to because they're trying to pass it over the line. And, you know, if they had a person like Charlie Austin, If one of those pretty passes lands to him in the box, he's not going to think about passing it back to someone, is he? He's going to try and rip the net. But I think, probably an interesting comparison actually is, I think Harry Kane's on, 13 or so goals now?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And, you know, he's playing for a side like Spurs, so you've got to say that, you know, with the number of goals he's scored, there's going to have to be a bigger team at some point who are definitely interested in, you know, what he brings to the table.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Kane, he's scored a lot of goals this season, but there's only 4 have been in the Premier League. A lot of them have come in the Europa League, a lot have come in the League Cup. So I think, don't discount his record, but it is a little bit skewed, similar to sort of Peter Crouch's England record, where a lot of the goals he scored were against quite poor teams. So Kane, I think, is a good player, and I think he played well on Saturday, although he does seem to shoot every time he gets the ball. But yeah, maybe not the fairest comparison.
He's probably playing in a more difficult situation, though, Hugh.
Yeah, maybe.
If you believe in that kind of thing, because he's playing at Spurs, and I think obviously there's expectation at Spurs that with the money they've spent, they're going to do well. Which kind of makes it even funnier, actually, that they're reliant on, you know, the fans seem to believe Harry Kane's their only chance of scoring. Which they've got some players they've spent quite a lot of money on. It's a little bit. A little bit concerning.
It is strange. I was surprised they only played him up front on Saturday. But anyway, let's move on from there. I do want to talk about Sam Vokes again. Played another 90 minutes for the development squad today, Monday. I can't remember who they were playing, but he scored 2 goals in the first half. He's having quite a productive pre-season, really, I suppose. This is Sam Vokes' pre-season, but that is his third 90 minutes now. We've got to be looking at getting him on the bench for one of the games over Christmas, don't we? I mean, how many more games is he going to play before he's going to be involved?
I think he'll be on the bench, Boxing Day. You know, whether he'll get a run out or not is, you know, another matter. But you've got to think he's going to be on the bench over the Christmas period, and he's going to get, you know, at least 20 minutes somewhere because, like you said earlier, there's such a, you know, congestion of fixtures. It's going to be difficult to expect, you know, both Barnes and Ings to do the amount of running that, you know, we expect of our forwards 3 times in a week.
Yeah, and also I think you look at the strikers that we've got on the bench, you know, Sordell and Jukovic, it's just, you look to them and think, how are we going to get a goal from them? I think it's psychological as much as anything, and especially with it being Liverpool, who have been so susceptible to set pieces and goals from headers. I just think it'd be a bit daft if we didn't have Vokes even just to throw on for his old 5 minutes off the bench at the end, just to see what he can do.
I'd say on Djokovic, actually, I do feel a bit sorry for him because he seems to be a bit of a whipping boy now. And I think you only have to look back to the Sunderland game where I thought he was really, really good. Some sort of miracle he didn't score in that game. And I think ultimately that's been the issue. The fact that he had games like that where he looked so good and he didn't score, which I think is perhaps maybe the only concern with Sam Vokes coming back. You know, people look into him like he's going to be a hero and he's going to score a lot of goals, and him and Ings are going to go back to, you know, the way things were in the Championship. But, I mean, at the same time, there's every chance that maybe he has a couple of really good games. You know, he's getting man of the matches, but he's not quite putting it in the back of the net. And he loses his confidence. And I think with quite a lot of strikers, it can be, if they lose the confidence, they're going to find it really hard to score goals.
It can be the flick of a switch, can't it? And sometimes it's something that's imperceptible almost. It's just gone, and then sometimes it's back, and it's difficult to tell where it's come from. But I think Jukic certainly low on confidence.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly look back at the games Jukic has played, and maybe one of the games since, you know, a ball hits him on the backside, goes in. That could just have been what he needed to get back on track. But, you know, it is difficult because, you know, you can see why strikers lose the confidence and, you know, from not scoring. But at the same time, it's the Premier League and it's, you know, it's one of the toughest leagues in the world. I mean, you can look at all the other leagues and say, you know, argue which league's better, etc. But I'd say it's almost impossible to argue that the quality across the whole league isn't higher as an average in the Premier League than it is elsewhere. And, you know, as a result, it's going to always be tough to score goals. And that's why people at the top end of the Premier League have paid so much money.
It's unforgiving, isn't it? And I see what you mean about Jukic. I thought he was very good at Leicester as well. He did a really good job of leading the line. But the problem I've got with him is that he's just never looked like scoring a goal. There's been no occasion at all that the ball's come to him in the box and I've thought he's going to score here. Where it's maybe not fair to compare him to Ings, but when the ball comes to Ings in the box, I'm confident he's going to make something happen. Even Barnes now, I'm starting to get the feeling that he's going to do something, especially after his goal on Saturday. Whereas Jukic, he does the link-up play all right and he gives defenders a bit of a working over, but he just doesn't look like he's going to score a goal. And I think you carry a player if it gets to that stage. You can't be playing two up front and one of them not being a goal threat at all. So hopefully Volks will come in and not do that.
You kind of hit on it there, but that it's kind of psychological in fans as well. Like the players we like are just like the reflections of what we see and what we like. Like Barnes 2 weeks ago, you'd never said you expect him to make something out of nothing. But suddenly after that Spurs game, we're like, yep, he can definitely make something out of nothing. And if Duke does that once, we said earlier that fans' opinions are quite stable. They don't change that much. But you could see people, if he does something spectacular out of the blue somehow, some way.
Yeah, I mean, the problem I've got with that is that I just don't see that happening. And you're right about Barnes' goal on Saturday not being something that anyone expected, but going back to last season, Barnes already showed this knack of coming up with key goals. He'd already scored two winners. And for all I've got problems with his general play and the way he throws himself to the floor, he has proven that he can score important goals, and Jukic certainly hasn't done that for us yet. And just on Volks and Barnes, it's probably early days to be talking about who's going to get the nod, but Barnes has made it very difficult to not pick him at the moment. Even if it is a few weeks until Volks is ready, he's probably going to have to be patient, isn't he? Unless he gets a game over the festive period while these fixtures are coming thick and fast. I wonder if Spurs in the Cup might be a good opportunity for him to get his first start if he's ready.
Yeah, I'd be looking at the Spurs in the Cup as a, you know, a game where I don't think we're going to make a lot of changes, because obviously the Cup is something we would definitely want to, you know, try and make a mark in. But you'd probably look and say, you know, maybe you play different wingers to what you played New Year's Day, and, you know, you play at least one different striker. Just because of what we said about, obviously, the amount of games there is over the festive period. You know, George, there's going to be no way George Boyd can run the crazy distances he runs every game four times, you know, between now and the 6th of January. So there's just no way you can expect him to play all those games, put that effort in. So you look at, you know, maybe the wingers, maybe a striker, and then you think maybe, you know, the rest can play with, you know, maybe minor changes. But, you know, that'd be as good a time as any to bring things back as a partnership.
Looking ahead to these Christmas games then, probably be the two before our next podcast. We are going to try and record next Monday, I think. So Liverpool, Man City, obviously on paper these are two very difficult games, but the form Liverpool are in, surely this is an opportunity to get something, and you'd say probably 3 points out of the two games would be a fantastic return, wouldn't it?
Particularly when you looked at the beginning of the season, obviously Liverpool haven't lived up to what people expected of them so far, but you know, I'd almost be inclined to kind of just write City off now and say anything you get at City is going to be, you know, a bonus. You know, we did see it last time in the Premier League, and obviously we got a really great result at the Etihad. But, you know, in most ways, you're going to say teams that you can almost write off visits to their ground in the Premier League are definitely Chelsea and City, because they're just teams who normally get the business done at home. But Liverpool, obviously, with the way they've played, the inconsistency they've shown, you know, you've got to think that depending on which side turns up, you know, our work rate and effort could really cause them trouble, and you know, you could be looking at a result there on Boxing Day, particularly with a sellout crowd, and you know, if the crowd's in the right mood, it could make a really good atmosphere.
Yeah, I think that was a good point. Just on the City game, actually, obviously we did get a result there last time, but our record historically against Man City is fairly terrible. Obviously they've got players out at the minute, they haven't got a striker, but they showed themselves to be quite adaptable in the Palace game at the weekend, 1-3-0, even without a striker. We talked a little bit about rotation, but would there be a case for even making wholesale changes for the City game and trying to keep people fresh for Newcastle? You talk about it being a game that we can almost write off. Would that be a bit far, making a lot of changes?
I can definitely see where people come from, and we have seen it before in the Premier League, you know, when smaller sides have gone to big teams over the festive period or over another period where there's a lot of fixture congestion, and they've put out, you know, what you wouldn't say was their first choice team. And then there's always the typical, you know, media uproar about how they're disrespecting the game, etc. And I think, you know, there is something in that. I wouldn't go as far as saying you're completely disrespecting the game, because, you know, you're trying to do ultimately what's best for your team. But I think in many ways you do have a duty to put out the strongest team you can. But, you know, certainly, I think, again, like I said for the Spurs Cup game, you're going to be looking at wingers in particular and thinking, can we really, you know, want to put them out there again just 2 days after the last game, expect them to do the same amount of running, and then do it again on New Year's Day against, you know, arguably a team that's going to give you more chance of a result.
Also, resting wholesale changes would be a very, very un Sean Dyche-like thing for Sean Dyche to do, because I don't think he's shown almost consistently throughout his tenure at Burnley that he likes consistency within the team. He likes to play the same team where he can, unless something's wrong or something clearly needs changing. So I just don't think I could envision Sean Dyche doing that. Just not, like, maybe it might be the best thing to do, but maybe not the thing that Sean Dyche would do.
I agree, but I also think James has got a really good point that a lot of our players rely heavily on energy and work rate and covering a lot of ground. And if you're asking George Boyd to run, what is it, like 8 miles he's been doing every game, asking him to do that twice in 3 days and then go and do it again 3 days later and then go and do it again 3 days after that, I just think you're going to give the bloke like a heart attack if you're asking him to do all that.
Yeah, I know, but you can't just write him off. You just say no, he won't be able to do it right at the start. You might, maybe you start him, but take him off after, however many, 60 minutes or like.
Yeah, when have you ever known Sean Dyche?
okay, maybe that was a bad example, but like there are alternatives. It's not all like it's not all you have to make wholesale changes or you can't change anything ever. So maybe we'll see some middle ground here. Like, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you are right that quite often we play with consistency. That was definitely the case last season. I mean, if you look at this season, there's definitely been a, you know, willingness to mix up who's playing on the wing. You know, there's definitely a call that, you know, we don't really like to mess with. But I can definitely see us playing, you know, several different winger combinations over the Christmas period, just because, like Jimmy said, you know, if George Boy runs 8 miles on Boxing Day, you know, I always go with, is if footballers shouldn't really complain about fixture congestion. At the end of the day, they are professional athletes. You know, this is what they are paid to do.
And it happens every year.
And he should be. And it happens. They know Christmas is coming. They know the fixtures are going to be busy. And, you know, he probably can run 16 miles, you know, in a football scenario in, you know, for the space of 3 days. But it doesn't mean it's the wise thing to do.
Yeah. But the question, you know, was...
I have no doubt he's capable of it. But, you know, there is going to be an element of fatigue. You probably want to say, well, if he runs that 8 miles against Liverpool, actually, that's going to do us a really good job. And maybe against City, you think, well, maybe if you put him on the bench and, you know, if it looks like we need him later on, you know, he can come out and he can run, you know, however far he'd run in 20 minutes. And then you're thinking, well, the game where we really need his running, his energy, he's going to be really fresh and he's going to be ready to go.
Yeah, but replacing a couple of wingers and maybe a striker isn't wholesale changes,
no,
to me.
No, which is what Jamie said, wholesale.
Yeah.
I said...
Yeah, well, I was asking the question, but I didn't really expect anyone to say we're going to do it. And also, I don't think we've got the staff to do it. I mean, we don't have a central midfielder to put in, so there's no way Jones or Marnie could get rested because there's nobody else to play there. What are we going to do, play Stephen Reid again? There's just no way. And unless Duff's fit, there's nothing we can do at the back either. And you're not going to leave Trippier out, and you're not going to leave Ings out. So there's probably half a dozen who are certainly going to play. I think James is right. I think the wingers will be the ones that will get rotated. Barnes might get one of the games off, but yeah, I don't think we're going to see an awful lot then. Let's round off with a couple of predictions then, just to round off this week's show. James, we'll start with you. Do you think we're going to get anything from these two games? Maybe a draw against Liverpool? Are you confident we can get something from that one?
I can't see us beating. I'm going to go with a positive prediction for Liverpool because I think, you know, the makings of a good day for us are there. A team that is in mixed form, coming to our ground on Boxing Day. It's a sellout. You know, if the crowd can, you know, get a really good atmosphere going, I think it'll be a really tough place for, you know, a team that's going through the form issues Liverpool are going through to come to, especially when quite a lot of the team is actually quite young. So I think, you know, be faced with 20,000, you know, Northwestern Burnley fans is going to, you know, be an intimidating sight for them if they're in full voice. So I'm going to go for 2-1 against Liverpool for us.
I agree. I think we can beat Liverpool. Seen their last couple of games and they really don't look that good. They've got obviously problems up front where Sturridge has been injured, Balotelli's been really mixed, they're trying to play Sterling up front, I'm not really sure it's been working. I'm confident we can get something there. I think we're going to get humped at City, but I'm confident that we can beat Liverpool. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think the same as James. I think that that we've got as good a chance as any, really, if the wrong Liverpool side turn up and they see that they're thrown into the atmosphere or the situation that'll be presented to them. So I was actually going to say 2-1 as well. So I'll say 2-1. Yeah, I won't change.
Brilliant. Fair enough. Well, that is about all we've got time for. Hopefully you've enjoyed this week's podcast. It has been a bit different from normal with not as many guests. If you are interested in coming on the podcast, by the way, please do get in touch. We are always quite short of guests. You can tweet us at nonanever.net or email us at podcast@nonanever.net. We've got to thank our sponsors at Neville G as well. We couldn't do the site or the podcast or anything else without them. And that's about all we've got time for before Christmas, really. So hopefully you all have a lovely Christmas, have a cracking time, don't drink too much, etc., etc. And we'll be back after the festive period. Goodbye.